1 second. Damn it. Won't go in my pocket, the radio. It just won't go in. Oh, okay. Well, that was a mistake. I certainly was. Everybody loves chalupas. Everybody loves them now. Wait, let's do it as Kirk. Everybody loves chalupas. Everybody loves them now. If you really want chalupas, we're the ones to show you how. Spock. Hey guys, this is Rish Outfield. And this is the Rish Outcast. In an episode that I recorded about 2 weeks ago, I went for a walk. I watched the sun go down. I meant to do an episode with a story attached, but I sort of lost track and didn't do it. And here I am, up at the family cabin again. Sun has already gone down. It's dusk. But you can hear all these lovely birds. It's been raining all day, but the rain stopped and they built a campfire, and I'm right here. Everybody else has gone in because it's cold, but I'm standing here by the campfire, warm, toasty, and alone. I felt like I ought to record something. You know what I mean? Because it's kind of nice. And you hear all those birds? You hear that? It's better than the roar of an engine, which you sometimes hear when I do one of these shows. It'll certainly make for an easier episode to edit. Also, I tend to get distracted while I'm driving. I wouldn't imagine that will happen. At least not in the same way. Last time there were deer, and I'd be like, oh wow, look, it's looking at me, that sort of thing. I was going to go for a walk right there by where I saw the deer the last time, but I just thought maybe it would be quieter. No more footfalls. And besides, I've got a short sleeve shirt on, and it's not summer weather. Wherever you are, I imagine it's not summer there either. But here I am. Today, I think I'm going to present to you a story called Remember the Future. It's a story I've written really, really recently. It's not, I mean, as of this recording, it's just over a month old. Yesterday, I was feeling sorry for myself because that's what I do. And I was thinking about how this has been a banner year. 2016 is when I'm recording this. This has been a banner year for my writing, just because I've written so much and I did a really good job. And then the weather started getting warmer. There started to be excuses to go outside. I started exercising and bike riding and things like that. And it's still no excuse. But my writing slowed. My productivity slowed. I was thinking that I hadn't done too well, but then I thought about June. June ended, and I wrote two stories in June. And guys, two stories in a month is fine. It's remarkable. I see people on Facebook. In fact, I think this is something I talked about 2 weeks ago when I recorded. But I see people on Facebook who are writers. You know, their job is to be writers. And, you know, they finish so much more stuff. It's like, oop, finished another story. Oop, sold another story. Oop, had the so-and-so podcast, another story. Ooh, audio rights, got scooped up for another story. And that makes me feel inferior, but this has been a fine year. I've done very well. And this is one of the stories I've written this year. And I guess I'll just present it to you, and then we can talk about it after if you want to. I mean, really, you're sort of strapped in and forced to listen. You're the taxidermied corpse of Norman Bates' mother, really. But I mean that in a good way, in the most complimentary way. So this story is called Remember the Future. And meet me on the other side, will you?
Remember the Future by Rish Outfield. Oh, I'll be found when I get lost in your eyes. Deborah Gibson. It wasn't that Tally Murray was cruel, or even particularly self-centered. Not for a 15-year-old girl, anyway. Let me tell you a couple of real horror stories sometime. But she often said things that were a little bit meaner than they needed to be. Pretty typical, actually. She was in the popular third or quarter of kids at Praiston High School, and maybe that made a difference in her personality. Tally had brown hair, small breasts, a button nose, with a cute, somewhat round face, the occasional blemish, but at the right angle, was just shy of beautiful. People liked her, girls and boys. She had a sharp wit, and rarely thought before she spoke. I think most of us can relate, but Tally just happened to do so at the wrong time, to the wrong person. That person was Laura Deming, who she only knew from her geometry class, and had always been bookish and quiet and unassuming, the kind of girl who would doodle endlessly on her quiz paper or math book pages if she had them, and on her arms and hands if she didn't. And noting this, Tally had mentioned that she looked like the drummer for a 1980s hair metal band, and imitated Laura singing, "We're not gonna take it. No, we're not gonna take it anymore." Laura had looked up at her, and the strangest expression moved across her pale face. At first, it was obvious hurt, a tightening of the lips, a reddening of the cheeks that signaled embarrassment, but then a narrowing of the brow and eyes that signified something else. What that something else was didn't occur to Tally until later, when she was getting off the bus, and met Lara's aunt or stepmother or something, a severe-looking woman who wore rings on all her fingers and some sort of weird rock around her throat, like a particularly ugly necklace.
"You're Tally," said the woman,
a stranger to Tally, and to every kid disembarking the bus at that time. None of them paid the lady any attention, too wrapped up in their conversations with friends, or their afternoon plans, or their omnipresent phones. Tally nodded.
"I understand you lack empathy, girl,"
the stranger said. Tally only vaguely understood what the woman was saying, but wilted back from her anyway. She radiated some kind of energy, some kind of authority, some kind of darkness that made Tally afraid, even though there was nothing unusual about the way she looked or spoke.
"What? I'm Laura Deming's guardian," said the witch. "And perhaps if you knew what she has suffered, you would be kinder. Or perhaps you wouldn't."
What does she suffer?"
Tally started to ask.
"Oh, her family had an unfortunate accident, dying in a crushed, flaming automobile on the coldest day of last January. Her mother, her father, her big, pretty sister, all dead."
The woman didn't sound sad to be relating such news. It almost seemed she was concealing amusement. Tally had not heard this before. Laura never spoke of her family. In fact, she couldn't remember when Laura had even started coming to their school, whether it had been years ago or earlier this term.
"Oh, no,"
she said.
"Oh, yes," said the witch. "Tragedy mirrors the footsteps of everyone's life. So you should have a bit more care with your barbed tongue."
There was no way to respond to that. Tally looked around, hoping to see others witnessing this confrontation on the sidewalk in the middle of the day. But no one else seemed to notice her and the powerful woman who was glowering at her.
"I see you have not yet been touched by death, child,"
the witch observed. Half of her mouth became a smile.
"Let's change that, shall we?"
And she put one gnarled, mummy-like finger out and touched Tally right on the breastbone with it. The finger belonged to a woman in her late hundreds, not the person that appeared to be standing before her now. The witch whispered some word, not in English, but not in any language still spoken on Earth. And then Tally blinked, and she was alone on the street by the bus stop, and there was no old woman around. But the damage had been done. Tally Murray's life was not the same after that, as she discovered when she went home and her foster mother was pulling up at the same time and asked her to help bring in the groceries. Tally opened her mouth to complain, but then, meeting Mama Gino's eyes, she had what could only be considered a vision. Mama Gino was in a hospital bed, not just thin, but practically a skeleton. Some kind of tube was hooked up to her nose, and another one to her arm. Her hair was as thin as a cheap doll's. Standing near the bed were two women, one a stranger, and one was Mama's adult daughter, Rhonda. Rhonda looked heavier, older than when Tally had last seen her, and was wearing glasses. Her eyes were red. Beside her, the stranger had been looking at Mama Gino, but now she stopped and turned, looking directly at Tally. And Tally's heart seized in her chest. She knew the woman, knew her better than anybody in the world. It was Natalia Gail Murray, an adult version, maybe in her 20s, maybe older. Her eyes were hard and cold, and she shook her head deliberately, as though disdainful of young Tally's presence there. Suddenly, one of the machines began beeping wildly. An alarm. Mama Gino was tight on the bed, one of her hands crumpled in a fist. And then the fist unclenched, and the machine beside her changed its tune. Tally's foster mother had just died of cancer. The clock on the wall showed the time, and below it, the date. It was only 8 years in the future.
Tally?
While there had been no tears in the grown-up Tally's eyes, the teenaged versions flooded with them as the vision receded.
Tally, baby, what's the matter?
Mama Gino was standing in front of her, alive and cancer-free, putting her hand on her face, concern in her voice. Tally was back in the present, but she knew, somehow she knew, that what she had just seen was going to happen in a few short years. A vision of her mom's death. That had been the first time. As the days became weeks, Tally's life was thrown into upheaval, as every time she made eye contact with someone, she was shown the location and circumstances of their death. It changed everything about her day-to-day existence, when she could answer her teacher's question and see that he would die in 20 years from a heart attack at a Little League game, or that her friend Mags would slip in the shower at 72 and break her neck, or that a total stranger she passed in the mall would fall asleep at the wheel coming home from a double shift at the county jail kitchen and never wake up. Apparently, that one was coming in less than 3 weeks. Whatever weaknesses and flaws of character she had exhibited before quickly disappeared as Tally began to understand the pointlessness of life, that there was an end to everything around her, and discovered she was no longer able to get close to people or truly know anyone, not with death there, always waiting around the corner. She retreated into herself, spending more and more time alone. And when she did interact with people, it was always over the internet or on the telephone. Through FaceTime or email, she could talk to her classmates without seeing them keel over from a heart attack, drown off the Florida Keys, or overdose on heroin. Over the next months, Tally's grades plummeted. Her wide circle of friends contracted, and her social skills atrophied. She grew distant even to Mama Gino, who always tried to pry the real reason for the girl's depression out of her and on the two occasions she actually got a true explanation, was understandably dubious about visions of the future or a curse from some witch at a bus stop. Tally didn't see the future with the hospital bed and the three women every time she spoke to her foster mother, but she saw it often enough to read different things into it, including the expression on her adult doppelganger's face as she turned to look at her right before the machines began to blare. Soon, she only had one friend still talking to her, Belen Danforth, who kept asking why Tally wasn't laughing anymore. What had made her friend so distant, if she had done something wrong? Tally told her it was nothing, and she'd be happy to call her or take Belen's calls any time, day or night. But Belen seemed hurt that Tally was reluctant to talk to her at school, and never came to her house anymore. She wanted the truth. But Tally didn't want to talk about the fact that Belen, who loved hiking and nature in all its forms, would one day get lost while hiking, dying slowly with two broken legs after a particularly nasty fall. Only not for 20 years or so. She saw a school counselor, who was a lucky one, dying peacefully on a plane coming back from visiting her grandchildren in approximately 35 years, who was determined to probe Tally's feelings about her birth parents and called her death-obsessed. But Tally eventually found a way to board up her mind to intimacy, to keep herself from really opening up to anyone. And it helped. Until one day, at school, she was at her locker, trying to find a pencil with an eraser on it, when someone she didn't know spoke to her. "Hey there," a boy said. He was standing 3 or 4 lockers down, trying to get it open, peering down at a piece of paper in his hand. Tally glanced over and quickly glanced back. She didn't think she had seen the boy before, but who knew?
"Do you have to go all the way around on the second number, or straight to it and then back the other way?"
the boy was asking. Tally wasn't sure what he was talking about.
"Dunno,"
she muttered. There was a broken half pencil at the bottom of her locker that had a full eraser on it, and Tally squatted to pick it up. When she stood, the boy was standing next to her.
"What I mean is, do you have to go all the way around the dial on the combination, or just straight to the second number?
Tally actually looked away from him, turning her back, even though she knew it would only be interpreted as rudeness. To make up for it, she said,
"I always spin my dial all the way around before I start." "Oh, okay,"
said the boy, and he went back to the locker down the line. Tally glanced back at him and saw the side of his face and an unruly amount of curly hair. She didn't know him. She closed her own locker and said,
"Good luck,"
then walked on to class. His name was Scott McComber, and he had just transferred to their school. He'd just gotten contact lenses, loved Sudoku, played the French horn in the band, and he saw her again that day during lunch. In the cafeteria, he had been trying to find a place to sit down and eat his sloppy Joe, when he saw Tally all the way in the back, in a table by herself. That was where she sat every day, and nobody ever bothered her about it. But Scott bothered her. She was staring into her phone, reading a travelogue about Ireland, when the new kid walked over to her and asked if he could sit there.
"Don't talk to me,"
Tally said, instinctively.
"Oh, okay,"
he said. And there was something deeply sad, profoundly resigned in the way he said it. He picked up his tray as soon as he put it down.
"Sorry."
She didn't recognize his voice and couldn't help but glance up. She didn't mean to, but she met his gaze, just trying to figure out who he was. And the vision began. Scott McComber looked the way he looked now, except slack-jawed and unkempt. He was in a dark room, next to a bed he had just finished making. He had a pistol on the pillow, and he picked it up. The safety was on, and he snapped it off, then put the barrel against his right temple. "In through the outdoor," he said, and pulled the trigger. He had been 17 years old. This wasn't a vision of an accident or sickness 20 years from now. It was soon. Suicide. Within the year. Tally had seen it all, including a policeman shot by a housewife and a football player choking himself while masturbating. But this vision shocked her. She was back in her own mind in just a moment, and the new kid, Scott, was turning to go. Why did he do it? Where did he get the gun? Was he thinking about it even now? Who was this guy? Why? And a new thought occurred to her. What if being pushed away by just one more person was all it took to push this guy over the edge?
"Hey," she said, louder than she usually spoke. "I didn't... Hey, come back."
Scott paused, his back to her, and she could sense him deliberating. He certainly hadn't deliberated when he picked up that handgun. He turned. He was a gawky-looking boy, still in that awkward age between adolescent and adult, but he had green eyes that were kind of nice, and that hair was the kind of thing you'd see on a circus clown, an obvious wig, except that it matched his eyebrows. He wore a t-shirt with Jack Skellington holding a Torah and matzo bread under a logo for The Nightmare Before Passover.
"Sorry,"
Tally said, reddening despite herself.
I thought you were somebody else. I didn't mean to be rude. Don't walk away. You can sit here."
It was more than she'd said to any student in person in the past week, and had come out in a torrent. Scott smiled.
"I'd hate to be that guy then," he said,
and she didn't know what he was talking about. Except that he smiled and came back to her table and sat down. Once she was no longer alone, Tally was tempted to fall silent again, go back to reading about County Donegal on her phone, just be comfortable as she rarely was. Except she had seen this guy at his lowest point, and she didn't. She had felt what he felt at that moment, had been that alone.
"I don't think I know you,"
she said at last. She had picked the exact moment he'd bitten into his sloppy Joe, and he tried to both chew and answer at the same time. He was amusingly unsuccessful.
"Just moved here. I saw you this morning. Asked you about the locker. I'm Scott."
Scott Bryant McComber, dead at 17 of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. The bullet had entered the right temple and lodged itself there into the brain. Quite tidy and mess-free as far as gun suicides go. Tally didn't know how she knew all that, but she didn't control what the vision showed her, and that was a big part of why she hated them.
"Natalia," she said.
He took a sip of his bottled water, then looked over at her. "Are you all right?" he asked.
"Yes."
She said it a little too quickly. She was used to that question, when people saw, or felt, the morbid connection pass between them. Usually she'd say she wasn't feeling well, or that her blood sugar was down. And once, she said that she'd eaten some bad clams, but she never dared tell the truth. This wasn't even the first suicide she'd seen, but it was the first one that was coming up so soon, even closer than right around the corner.
Where did you move from?
Las Vegas. My mom worked as Celine Dion's personal assistant.
You're kidding,
Tally said, not sure if that was fascinating or totally lame.
Yeah, said Scott, shrugging. It was actually Marie Osmond.
Oh.
Tally looked at the guy. He was skinny, had freckles on his arms, and something goofy about his smile. Did he have to kill himself? If he liked it here in town, made a couple of friends, had a reason to look forward to next week or next year. Maybe he only needed one friend.
I love Marie Osmond. Got a tattoo of her name right on my...
She trailed off. You're... Scott asked, grinning. And damned if Tally didn't find herself grinning back.
My grandma's inner thigh.
Scott's smile faded. Yikes.
Pleased to meet you, Scott. What do you play in the band?
She asked it already knowing, just as she already knew that he liked to make up crossword puzzles. He'd had a crush on his second cousin when he was 13, and his father had walked out when he was 8.
French horn. Kinda lame, I know.
No, I think Kurt Cobain played the French horn. Or tickler, one of those instruments.
This was really weird. She never made these kinds of jokes, let alone to someone she didn't know. Except, of course, she did know Scott McComber. And she didn't want him to kill himself. What if she could stop it? What if none of it had to happen? What if all these horrible visions she kept having were just glimpses of what might happen? After all, it was a curse, right? She was really going to try. After all, she knew what the worst that could happen was.
People confuse the two all the time, he said.
The what?
She asked, then shook her head.
I like your shirt.
The next day, there he was in the morning, same as her, 4 lockers down from hers.
Hey, Natalia,
Scott said. She, purely out of habit, didn't meet his eye, but she said,
Tally, you can call me Tally if you want.
He chuckled.
Like that song.
What song?
And he began to sing in a silly, low-pitched Jamaican Islander voice, Come, Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana. Several students looked over at him, and one guy said, Not cool, man, before moving on. Tally, too, looked over and met Scott's eye. His room was dark. His hands were cold, and so was the grip of the pistol as he lifted it toward his head. She looked back into her locker again.
You've never heard that song before?
He asked, and started to turn red. But that didn't stop him from continuing the song.
Deo, deo, daylight come on me one go home.
The guy was a clown, obviously. But Tally knew that it was some kind of an umbrella, a shield that hid a loneliness and a... Well, despair was the only word for it.
Okay, okay, I get the point. Tally said. My name is Weird.
No, not Weird. Just from a Calypso song.
What does Calypso mean?
I don't know, actually, Scott said. Just an old kind of music. Like reggae, before it was reggae.
What's reggae?
Asked Tally. Scott laughed. But it hadn't been a joke.
What class you have first period?
Tally asked as Scott closed his locker.
Teen law.
Is that a real class?
Yeah, Mr. Quadlist or something.
There's really a class called teen law.
Yep. They tried calling it law for dummies, but the teachers kept wanting to attend.
Tally didn't laugh, exactly, though she was pretty sure that had been a joke. She turned and faced Scott McComber.
Hey,
she said, and he stopped. She looked into his eyes, just for a second. Nothing came.
What?
Scott asked.
Do I have something on my face?
Yeah, a nose and a mouth. You should get that looked at.
He nodded at her and went to class. Tally stayed in the hall for another minute, thinking. This was the first time she'd wanted to see somebody's fate, and it didn't happen. Maybe that was part of the curse. So she went to her world history homeroom and stared intently at Melinda Chittister 2 rows over. Melinda, who would die from riding in a car with a texting driver who was currently 8 years old.
I want to see how you die,
thought Tally, fairly deliberately and very morbidly.
What?
Melinda whispered, meeting her gaze. And the imagery played, of the sister looking down, the car moving just enough out of their lane that a Suburban coming in the other direction couldn't miss them. Melinda opening her mouth to tell her sister to look at the road, and then the impact.
You look good today. Thinner,
Tally whispered back. Ha ha, Melinda grunted, and turned back to the talk of the rise of the Soviet Union at the front of the class. On Wednesday, Belen made her daily attempt at coaxing Tally out of her shell, asking her if she wanted to go over to Jamba Juice with her and 2 freshmen she was sort of friends with.
Sorry,
Tally said, looking intently at Belen's green Skechers.
Though spending $6 on fruit cocktail in a blender does sound nice.
Belen nodded, seemed about to say one more thing, then turned and joined her friends. Tally watched her go, wishing she could say yes, but not willing to watch her friend die of exposure at the bottom of a ravine, again, or however the other 2 students would meet their ends. Still, she admired that Belen kept trying to be her friend. It inspired Tally to keep it up with Scott. And the next time Tally saw him and made eye contact with him, she saw the vision again. He looked exactly like he was in front of her, his hair about the same length, the neatly made bed beside him, the same one he slept in the night before. Though she couldn't really know that, except that she did. He put the gun to his head and said, "In through the outdoor," before pulling the trigger.
"Were we in a staring contest just then?" Scott asked,
when Tally came back to herself.
"Me? No, I... It's a long story."
They were in the lunchroom, and Scott had asked if he could sit across from her, and she'd said yes, though she'd gotten used to sitting alone, and it almost didn't bother her anymore. Almost. Tally had a taco salad, and had only eaten about 1/3 of it. Scott had a plate of waffles. Did they really sell waffles in the school cafeteria?
"Well, I'll listen, if you want to tell it. I'll swap you for a juicy Marie Osmond story."
"Is that a thing? There are juicy Marie Osmond stories?"
"No, but I was going to make one up."
He cut off a piece of waffle.
"She really hates homeless people. Hates them."
"Really?"
Tally asked. To be honest, she barely knew who Marie Osmond was, just that she was a bland female singer that appealed to old people, like Barbara Streisand, Olivia Newton-John, Whitney Houston, and Josh Groban.
"No, she's nice, actually."
He narrowed his eyes. "A little too nice, if you ask me." Tally hadn't, but proceeded to eat more of her salad, squelching the desire to ask Scott why he was so unhappy. She had considered writing him an anonymous note, since she knew where his locker was, and had thought about it with several doomed students, maybe writing Melinda Chittister a "You ought to institute a no-texting rule in the car" note, just to try. But she'd never done it, choosing instead to get less involved with her classmates' lives, rather than more so. But not this time.
"You got a big family?"
Tally finally asked. And Scott answered her. "Nope. Just him and his mom and brother, who was in the Marines now." She wondered if that's where he got the gun. But of course, she couldn't ask that. A little while later, she caught his eyes wandering and turned around to see Chloe Vandevoer walking past, talking to a couple of pals. Chloe was a cheerleader and had been pretty close friends with Tally just 1 or 2 before. When Tally turned back to Scott, his attention was right where it was supposed to be. But the damage was done. She had an idea.
"You want to set me up with who?"
Chloe asked in gym class.
You don't know him, Tally said. At least, I don't think so. He just moved to town last month. He's in the band. Ugh. Then why do you think I'd want to go out with him?
Chloe squatted to tie her tennis shoes, the neckline of her t-shirt plunging dangerously. Tally looked elsewhere, which she had gotten quite good at lately.
He's funny. You like funny guys. And he thinks you're hot.
Chloe bit back whatever she was going to say. Probably something about everybody thinking she was hot. And that went without saying. Tally went on.
Anyway, I know you and Mitchell broke up, so I thought...
Chloe interrupted her.
You've ignored me for the last month, and now you want me to ask out some friend of yours?
Tally couldn't tell her that she knew the cheerleader would die at 61 while choking on an artichoke heart, whatever that was. And what the ravages of age would do to Chloe was almost as disturbing as watching her die.
I'm sorry. I sent you emails almost every day, and if you like this guy so much, why don't you ask him out?
Chloe said. Tally thought that was a no-brainer. Every boy liked Chloe. Her skin was relatively acne-free, and she had somehow avoided that awkward age between 11 and 14, gradually blossoming from a cute girl to a hot girl. Plus, she had really big, bouncy boobs ever since 7th grade. They made guys into no-brainers, too. But ah well, Tally would try something else. So, painstakingly at first, she began to show Scott McComber attention. Always saying hi to him, even if she had earlier in the day, asking him his impressions of the school, and introducing him to the people she liked the most. She still made sure not to look any of them in the eye, if she could help it. And believe it or not, there were still many, many students at PHS that she didn't know the ultimate fate of, simply due to not knowing them or interacting with them directly. But she made sure he knew school newspaper editor Dusty McDaniel, who would die of pneumonia at the age of 78, Austin Houston, who had already parlayed his ridiculous name into a rockabilly band and would die asleep in bed, age of 80, and junior class president Corb Donaldson, who would pass in less than 4 years from a fraternity prank gone wrong, when he'd end up falling from the ceiling and hitting his head on a coffee table. Scott appreciated the attention of the other students, and Tally pretended to be interested in what he was interested in. Until, on a couple of them, like adult coloring books and the early releases of the Rolling Stones, she genuinely began to care about that stuff herself. Over the next few weeks, Scott began to see the world differently. And amazingly, so did she. Ever since the curse was placed upon her, she had found her newfound intimacy with others had made her feel more and more lonely, less and less a part of their lives. But with Scott, she felt like seeing into his head gave her the chance to be a better friend to him, and understood him in a way that people rarely understand one another. And one afternoon, while Scott lingered at her locker, his face a bit closer to her hair than strictly necessary, she turned her head and made hard eye contact. It was evening, and in a city. She could tell by all the lights and the ugly orange color of the sky. Scott was atop a parking garage, which was only 6 levels tall, but as he approached the edge, was tall enough. He was already good and drunk, but he lifted the bottle of Jim Beam to his lips anyway, and drank down all that was left. Then he gently set the bottle down on the pavement and climbed up on the lip of the roof. He had to hang onto the railing there because of the way the world was swaying back and forth, but with minimal effort, he got his left leg over the rail, and then his right. He looked down, a long way to fall, but there was nobody down there he might land on.
In through the outdoor, Scott McComber said, making an almost tittering sound, and launched himself from the roof.
Tally fell with him, and time slowed as the body plummeted, long enough for her to see that his hair was longer, and he had a weird, scraggly mustache on his lip. He'd been out of high school for 2 years. And then Tally was back in the present, back in front of the locker, and the teen Scott was staring at her with a confused expression on his face. What?
I...
Tally, he asked, seeing that look in her eyes. She had postponed the vision, changed the future, made a difference. And she kissed him. Over the next few days, Tally and Scott saw a lot of each other. They never had sex, but there was a lot of kissing, and a wee bit more groping than she ever intended. Tally had never had a steady boyfriend before. Poor Scott had never kissed a girl before that afternoon by their lockers, and it was a new way to go about her day. It was also exhausting. Scott always wanted to hang out with her now, always wanted to go where she went, eat what she ate, even if he hated it, and talk to her on the phone whenever he got a chance. She felt affection for Scott, certainly, but mostly she felt protective of him. And though she had no younger siblings, she felt for him what she imagined she'd feel for a little brother. Scott was into all kinds of music and enjoyed playing different songs from different eras and genres just to see if she'd like them. Later, Tally found that he didn't like most of it himself, but got a kick out of seeing her reaction to Latin dance, New Age, Calypso, one song in particular, Christian rock, and beat poetry. Scott had a recording Marie Osmond had personally given him of herself singing Part of Your World from an old Disney movie, and they listened to it together in the dark, holding hands and looking up at the ceiling of the apartment where Scott lived. During that moment, which Tally would look back on fondly for years to come, she nearly told him her secret. She wanted someone else to know. But she hadn't told her mother or her friends because she didn't want them to look at her with the expression, well, that she often had when reading a person's future. There was that rush of unwanted intimacy, a loss of innocence, and calling it an overshare didn't quite cut it. And if she told her boyfriend about the curse, she knew what he would ask. And what could she tell him when he asked how he would die? Nobody wanted to know that, from those who would expire of a heart attack on a roller coaster to those who took their own lives. Maybe she'd tell him in time, just not now. Belen Danforth, who had been Tally's last remaining friend, finally stopped extending olive branches to her and no longer called on the phone or sent emails. Her last text read, "Saw you and that boy at assembly today. You look happy. I'm glad." Though it saddened her that there seemed to be something fatalistic about this last message, Tally had to concede. She was happier now than she had been, certainly since before getting cursed by that now-forgotten girl's witch mother. The pale blonde who used to write on herself in algebra was now gone from class, and presumably from school, but Tally never felt suspicious about it, and oddly, never gave her a second thought. There was a girls' choice dance coming up. The school used to have some kind of clever name for it, but somebody had decided to call it the Spring Formal, because that sounded more 20th century. And the theme this year was Remember the Past. A lot of Tally's fellow students were coming up with clever and or outlandish ways to ask out their current or future boyfriends. But Tally simply bought two pieces of poster board and drew a maze on it, with little doors at every turn. You opened each door, and a question was posed on the sheet behind it. "Do you like school dances?" said one. And if he said yes, he went right. If he said no, he went left. Only the correct answers led to the end of the maze, where the question was, "Tally Murray requests your presence at the school formal," which wasn't really a question, and she didn't realize until later that it should have said, "requests your presence." Regardless, Scott said yes, and they went to the dance together, driven by Mama Gino's brother in his old black Chrysler, like a limousine. Both of them dressed like 80s punk rockers, even though most of the students had gotten ball gowns, poodle skirts, and suits with top hats. The sound system played Glenn Miller as they danced, and Tally took the opportunity to ask, "Scott, are you happy?" Me? You're the one who should complain. I've only stepped on your feet 100 times tonight.
50 times at most, she said.
But she leaned in close and said,
Do you ever think about killing yourself?
His body tightened up a bit at that. He froze for a moment, then continued to sway to Moonlight Serenade. My dancing that bad?
Nope,
she said, and it was true.
I had a cousin that killed herself a long time ago.
It was not a lie, although it was Rhonda's cousin, not Tally's, which she supposed meant the woman was no relation to Tally. Still, dead was dead. Scott sighed.
Yeah, sometimes I do. It's been a long time, though.
They kept dancing.
I was pretty lonely before I met you,
she said. That was also not a lie, though she still found herself feeling lonely and missing her friends in the way life used to be. He held her closer, his body just a bit too tall to fit hers like a glove. She could feel his heartbeat through all the layers. Tally didn't say any more. She had glimpsed a gasping death due to allergic reaction to bee stings in a girl she didn't know at the punch bowl, and was dwelling on that when Scott stopped dancing. He stepped back, studying her.
Why? Do you think about killing yourself?
No.
Natalia, don't do it. You are nice and beautiful and funny. No girls are funny, Tally. Try to remember that.
Tally was mildly insulted by that statement, but nodded and finished the dance with him. He kissed her on the cheek when it was done. Her friend, / ex-friend, Chloe, appeared later with a handsome Miller's Fork senior on her arm. Chloe was dressed as a flapper and had done something truly awful, and probably period accurate, to her hair, but she still looked radiant. She mouthed,
Is that the guy you talked about?
Tally nodded, and her friend gave her a thumbs up. Later, when the theme from Titanic was playing, they went outside for some fresh air. Tally's Uncle Dee wasn't coming back with the car until 10 o'clock. They held hands and watched two fellow students making out against the announcements box outside the school doors.
My dad called the other day,
Scott said, seemingly out of the blue.
He got a job in Henderson and wants us to come out. My mom and me and my brothers. He hopes she'll take him back and that we'll be a family again.
It was dark and hard to tell what Scott felt about this.
What does your mom think?
She's making minimum wage at the Albertsons here in town. She's talked to him a couple of times, for hours. I think she's considering it.
Where's Henderson?
It's right outside Vegas, like 20 minutes.
What do you think you'll do?
Tally asked.
I don't know.
What do you want to do?
Stay here. Go back, dance some stupid disco song with you, then do what they're doing,
he said, indicating the couple dry-humping a few yards away.
Uh-huh, Tally said. That's not what I was asking.
I know. I can't decide. On the one hand, you. On the other, my mom really misses my dad. Misses being a complete family. I guess I do, too.
Do you even have a choice in the matter?
No, I guess not. My dad asked me what I thought, but I have to do what my mom does.
Scott chuckled.
He was impressed I have a girlfriend.
So am I,
Tally said, and took his hand.
Let's go back in there before we miss that stupid disco song.
The dance went well, as did the making out, and they cuddled for a while during the limo ride back. They texted once over the weekend, and on Monday, saw each other in between classes as before. Scott's mother had decided to go back to Nevada, and since she had not yet found a house in town, That made the move easier. They would be moving as soon as they could get packed up, which was also made easy by the fact that most of their belongings were still in cardboard moving boxes. Scott's father had even enrolled him in Del Sol High School, near where they would be living. Scott asked Tally what she thought of all that.
I don't know. I'll miss you, but...
She squinted his way.
Hard to believe we've only known each other for 2 months.
She had another vision. Scott McComber was an old man, with barely a hair left on his head, though his eyebrows certainly were bushy. Sitting in an uncomfortable chair in a retirement home, there were 3 Father's Day cards on a desk beside him, and he stared out the window at an overcast afternoon in late September. He closed his eyes, didn't open them again.
"You were drooling onto a hospital gown!"
Tally exclaimed, unable to help herself, and laughed in shocked delight. Scott laughed too, but he had totally missed the joke.
"That's the nicest thing you've ever said to me, I think."
Tally embraced him, kissing him on the neck. But it was not a romantic kiss. She held him tight. She had changed his destiny, or helped him change it himself.
"I think you'll be happy in Henderson,"
she whispered.
"I hope so. You... What's going on, Tally?"
"I can't explain it,"
she said, though she was a little bit tempted to try.
"I think I like you more like a brother than a boyfriend. Does that make sense?"
He paused, biting back whatever negative thing he might have said under other circumstances.
"Yeah, I sort of always got that from you. Just didn't want to say anything."
"Yeah?"
she asked. He certainly hadn't kissed her like a sibling, fumbled with her bra like a sibling.
"Not that I know what it's like to have a brother."
He broke their embrace.
"You do now."
Scott McComber's destiny had changed. And that meant her destiny had changed too. If she could see futures, then change them. Scott and his family moved away the next weekend. Tally came over to help them load up the U-Haul truck. She gave him the picture of the two of them from the Remember the Past dance. She hugged and kissed him, and did the same to his mother, and watched them drive away. She had tears in her eyes, but they dried quickly. The last look she had shared with Scott had shown an understanding between the two of them, and no visions of the future. She felt good, and instead of calling Mama Gino to come pick her up, she chose to go for a walk. She had a lot on her mind, and decided to go to her favorite place in town, the top of Chenugana Hill, which overlooked most of the valley. On her way, she passed the Shop and Go convenience store, and without planning to, went inside. She went in the restrooms in the back, and did something she hadn't done in a long time. She stood in front of the mirror and took a hard look at herself, right in the eyes. She had never gotten a vision of herself. In fact, the only time she ever entered into one of the future death scenarios had been the first one, where her foster mother had died. But she had so feared getting one that she'd actively avoided mirrors, even to brush her hair or put on makeup, which she no longer did, blemishes be damned. But nothing happened. Nothing ever happened when she saw herself. But it was now with a combination of relief and disappointment that her own future was not revealed.
"Figures,"
she muttered. She exited the restroom feeling somehow let down, and bought a pack of gum from the clerk. As awful as her curse was, the young clerk would drive his car off a bridge and into a shallow river. It was somehow lessened now that she knew she could make a difference. What kind of difference would 7 or 8 years make with cancer treatment for Mama Gino? Or asking the guy behind the counter to always wear his seatbelt? Or Eric Choner at school, who was destined to get killed in his pickup truck while driving through Little Rock, of all places. An anonymous note telling him how dangerous Arkansas is. She could try something. Anything to feel the way she felt right now, having made the difference in one cool, curly-haired boy. She walked the rest of the way up to the biggest hill in town, where two children were currently rolling down its side, getting grass stains all over their clean clothes. She watched as the sun began to touch down in the distance over the lake, the sky starting to turn into a lovely pink and orange.
"Hello, girl?"
a female-accented voice asked. Tally glanced up, not making eye contact, and saw an Asian lady approaching her. Her husband stood behind her, a tiny infant in his arms. He gave her a smile, and she smiled back. They were from Chiang Mai, Thailand, living in the U.S. on a work visa, but that visit would be brief. She saw the man, his wife, and two children standing on a beach, all of them looking in horror at the water receding in front of them. People were already beginning to flee. A wave, a massive white-tipped wall, was moving slowly toward the shore. The father screamed, scooping up his baby daughter, Chanthira, who had been sitting in the sand. His wife looked around for Atid, who was 5, but couldn't see him with all the panicking, terrified people. The cries of the victims were overpowered by the roar of the water. The wave came crashing down upon them, destroying everything it touched. Right before it hit, Tally saw Atid, staring up at the wave in awe rather than fear. Then she was back in herself.
"You take a picture for us?"
the mother, Dao, asked, holding out her camera.
I guess...
Tally said. The Thai family stood together, backed by the sunset, and Tally took the picture. In the vision, the baby in his father's arms had been about 5. He looked 1 now, maybe younger.
"You're from Thailand?"
Tally asked, though she shouldn't have known that.
"Yes, all,"
the mother said.
"What are you doing in town?" "I work at cherry plant in Mackay. My husband look for job."
Boon Mi smiled and said,
"No English."
"If he finds job, we stay in America. If no finds, then we go back."
Tally nodded, handing the camera back to the husband.
"Maybe I can help,"
she said. The end.
So, say it with me, folks.
It's not a great story.
Funny thing is, I like that so much, the chorus of ghostly children saying that. What's not to like? So, I don't know what to say about the story. There's kind of a backstory behind it, not really. Just, they hired this new girl at work, and she was so young and like almost Disney-like in her innocence, like Amy Adams in Enchanted. And I enjoyed the few weeks that I saw her. Just a very young and lovely little thing. So I sort of modeled the character on her, but I can't say where the idea came from. I have so many, like, little sparks of ideas that could go somewhere or could not. Do you know what I mean by that? Like, I'll get an idea in my head and I think, oh, wow, that has the potential to be great. Or, I don't know. Or just a moment or a visual image or, like, an ending or a scare or whatever. Because, I tend to write horror. And in this case, I don't know what it was that inspired the story. I think the character of Tally was going to be more bitchy and sarcastic and kind of snotty when I was writing this thing. But that girl at work was just so sweet and guileless that I was like, well, Okay. The thing with a story like this is, again, A, I don't know if it's any good. So, you know, should I share it with you or not? But B, you know, it feels a little more intimate. Is that the word? I mean, like, there's a novella I wrote called Popcorn Movies. And I haven't shared that with a lot of people because it's personal to me. The main character is a loser who went off to Los Angeles and he had these opportunities, or he had talent, or he had youth, and he squandered it. And then he came crawling back home with his tail between his legs. And there should be absolutely no question who that character is based on. You dig? And so when I published that story, I was just like, oh gosh, I'm afraid of somebody reading that and seeing into my soul and saying, F this guy, which is groundless. I mean, who's ever going to read that story anyway? And this story isn't tremendously intimate. It's just, maybe it's because there's sort of a romantic element to the story, maybe a more personal aspect to it. And, you know, I don't know what I'm doing there. Maybe I'm putting myself more at risk writing something like that than, you know, writing about demons or maniacal monster children. I'm now standing where I was when the sun went down, and I was just almost floored at the beauty of it all in that other episode. And I am embarrassed if this episode airs before that other episode. It doesn't seem likely because, you know, this has a story attached to it. And the story ones always take longer. Granted, I could do better. I could do more. In fact, I'm at the cabin and I had meant to publish another Rish Outcast. Not publish it, but schedule it. You know what I mean? Where I get everything ready and go push, publish. But I've got the time set so it would be, you know, the next day or the next day. So while I was gone, an episode would drop. But I forgot to do that. Doesn't matter, right? You know, I don't write a lot of romance. I haven't written a ton of that. And God knows I'm not good at romance in real life. And you write what you know. So this story has a little bit of that in it. If people like this story, that's great. If they don't like it, you know, what can I do? But just write another story. Keep writing. Maybe try and make teenage romance more real or fudge. I don't know. The other thing I just wanted to mention, one little thing about this story, is as I was writing it, I had to come up with a reason that she got cursed. And so I was going to have her be insulting to a gypsy woman, or maybe it wasn't a gypsy woman. It was going to be like an old Chinese woman it was going to be at a Chinese restaurant, and she was rude to her or something like that. And then I thought, you know, why not just have it be the witch from Like a Good Neighbor? So it's old Widow Holcomb that curses Tally. And if you've not read Like a Good Neighbor, you have to have read that by now. Because I believe that one was on the Doonstief. And people hear the Doonstief. So there's that. Austin was my boss at work when I was writing this. And he had shown a great deal of support for my writing. And I had tried to be really supportive of him in his art. Because he's just a fantastic artist. So he had said, you know, just tell me what you want for your covers and I will do it. He was really exuberant about it. And I wish a year ago I had discovered he was an artist. And I wish I had known that time was fleeting. Because I'm speaking about this job in the past tense now. And yeah, they kicked me to the friggin' curb. I'd worked at this job for a long time. And I'd been passed up for promotions, which is fine because I had been asked before, you know, where I saw myself and if I wanted a promotion and or more responsibility and all that stuff. And I had said that, look, I like it where I am right now. I take on extra responsibility if I see that it needs to be taken. You know, if something needs to be done, I do it. But I don't like the idea of having to do it every single time and other people just saying, oh, well, we aren't going to lift a finger because it's his job to do that. I like being part of a team, and I like lifting my own weight. And then, you know, if there's some place where I can help above and beyond my job, I like doing that. And they tossed me out of my ass. Sorry about the language. You know, there were one or two people at work that I really enjoyed working with. And, you know, then there were other people that made life a little more difficult. But one of the good ones was this guy, you know, that I've mentioned a bunch of times, but all in really recent episodes. Just because we became friends, you know, right before the end, I guess. He did the cover art for my first book, Into the Furnace. And it looks like that's it. He texted me that weekend, and he, you know, to let me know that he was not in on this, that it came as a surprise to him, and that he was upset about it, but sorry. And I believe that, absolutely. But I've had no contact with the guy, and I just... I feel like out of sight, out of mind is probably what's going to happen. I mean, maybe I could contact him tomorrow or something, or well, when I come back and say, hey, you still have interest in doing this with me? I mean, it would be great if I could count this guy as a friend, like an actual social friend, because, you know, I looked forward to the shifts that we had together because at least once a week he would get out his iPad and show me what he was working on. I don't know. He was a really good boss, co-worker, whatever you want to call it, supervisor. Well, okay, so the story is a little bit about a relationship that ends, right? A romance. And, you know, you look at a romance that ends, and it's all too easy to think about the way that it ended, to think about the fact that it did end. To think about the fact that you're not with her anymore, or him, or it, I suppose, trying to come up with a third option. And too often, that's what you dwell on, is that last fight, or the straw that broke the camel's back, or what she brought to the table that caused it to end, or what you brought to the table that ruined everything, or, you know, if there was a big argument, you replay that argument, you think of the things that you should have said at the time, or you replay the things that she said that were particularly nasty, and now you have an even nastier response because it's over, because it ended. Why not say what you wanted to say and all that? And I guess there's a parallel between Remember the Future and me. Shoot, now I remember how I got on this subject. I had spoken to the artist, and he said, what are you working on? And I said, oh, right now I'm working on a story about a girl who knows how people are going to die. He said, well, oh, really? That's interesting. And I read to him the part. Well, just see, I had made a list of interesting ways that people could die. And I think that's what I read to him. He's like, wow, so what kind of cover art do you want for that? And I said, oh, I already know. It's like a young girl... face, and there are skulls reflected in her eyes. And he's like, oh, yeah, I could do that. That'd be cool. And, you know, I wish I were a better artist, because I would just make that myself. And he told me about programs where you can just take, like, a photograph and paint over the photograph and then remove the photograph element so all you have is what you painted. And I think I could do that, although, you know, I don't know, because it's digital paint, right? And do you use your finger? Do you use a stylus? Do you use a mouse? I don't know. But it's kind of the amount of work that it would take to translate what I see in my mind right now. to something that you could see. You know what I mean? It's so easy for me to have that image of the eyes and the skulls reflected in them. But actually capturing that so that it looked like a reflection, so it looked like a teenage girl, I don't know. I don't know how much effort that would take. But I could write another story in that time. That I know. And no cover art that I create is ever going to win any awards. Although I did really, really like my cover art for Anacoinosis. It takes a little bit of effort to get to the end of a story. You know, once you get it in your head to write a story, you start. And not all of the ideas that jump into my head end up getting started as stories. And certainly not all of the stories that I start end up getting finished. And I guess by extension, not all of the stories that I finish end up getting published where you can read or hear them. But that's neither here nor there. Ooh, I said neither, like Big does. I've found that art is really cathartic. You know, you're afraid of something. You get your heart broken. You're upset. You know, you're angry. You lose your job. You lose a family member. You lose a girlfriend. You lose a car. You lose an ear. You lose your butt virginity. You lose things, and writing or sculpture or songwriting or whatever it is a way to deal with it. You lose these things and you can deal with it. And, you know, heck, podcasting is that as well. I'm lucky, really, that I have that I have that outlet, that I have that escape, that I have that advantage, that I have you guys. Even if there's only one or two people listening, you make it easier, you make it better, you make me feel like I'm not alone. You make me feel like a natural woman. Sorry. I'm smiling right now, even though, you know, I'm kind of a loser and who knows what's going to happen in the future. Which brings us back to the title, right? Not a great title, Remember the Future. Lame. But I like the story. And I've liked this episode. It's it's a learning experience. All 70 whatever years of it, you learn, you grow, you stumble, you fall, you get back up. I don't know. I'm happy that I have the Rish Outcast. I'm happy that I have this little recorder. I'm happy that I have a warm fire that I'm now standing in front of because, wow, my feet got cold. Thanks for listening. Thank you for being there, helping me through hard times. The one person I'd like to thank who's never going to hear this is Kevin MacLeod of the Clan MacLeod, the podcaster's friend. He is a very talented musician, and he puts out his music under a Creative Commons license, allows people to use it however they see fit. I've used his music on probably every single story episode of this show. Probably episodes that weren't story episodes, too. Oh, yeah, I use Americana anytime I'm doing a sidekick story on the air. So I got to keep that file on my hard drive, which I guess is a hint of things to come. But yeah, it's really good music. Evocative. He's got this website over at incompetech.com where you can look up his music by genre. You can look it up by, well, title, obviously, by mood, which I think is great. You know, if you want something mysterious, you want something uplifting, you want something sad, romantic, whatever it is, it's really helpful. Good stuff. And just like Kevin MacLeod's music, my show is produced under a Creative Commons attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives 3.0 license. So you are free to share Remember the Future with somebody that you despise or love. You can copy it, you can download it, and play it for your friends. But you're not allowed to take credit for it, you're not allowed to try and sell it yourself. The Creative Commons license is also a podcaster's friend. And I'd like to think that you are this podcaster's friend. Good night.
Its eyes were big and black and shiny, reflecting the lantern light like reflecting the lantern light like reflecting reflecting the lantern light reflecting the lantern light reflect reflecting the lantern light like fudge reflecting the lantern like reflect reflecting the lantern light like tiny fireplaces.
Zero. Oh, wow, you can actually see my breath. So that means it's cold. I mean, not cold, but you know what I mean. Just between you and me, it's July. I'm recording this in July and I can see my breath. So yikes. Anyway, kids, give me just a second. More vehicles are coming and they're scaring the deer that I'm watching. God, it sounds like they're driving a fucking riding lawnmower over broken glass is what that sounds like. So let me cut that shit out. I mean, I shouldn't be upset, but it just feels like they're intruding on my peace. Plus, there are those deer. There were three of them right there. Same place I saw them last time. And they were just eating grass and being alive. And then this filthy, diesel-spewing, loud-noised vehicle goes by with its bright lights. And of course, the deer run for the hills. And I just, I don't know. It's good that I don't have godlike powers, because it would be wrong for me to kill these people. Let's have that be an outtake, okay?